Big issues, big names, an interview every month. It's Not That Simple, a podcast from Francisco Manuel dos Santos Foundation.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of It's Not That Simple from the Francisco Manuel dos Santos Foundation. Delighted to be here recording this episode in front of a live audience in Lisbon. And it is a special occasion because we're also addressing a very important topic, which is migration. And I'm delighted to welcome our host, Hein de Haas. Hein, welcome.
Thank you.
Fantastic to have you on board. I'll give a quick introduction, even though most people here and most people watching probably know who you are. That's why they're here and tuning in. You're from the Netherlands, a renowned sociologist, geographer, professor of sociology at the University of Amsterdam, also founder and co-director of the International Migration Institute at the University of Oxford. You've obviously also been writing various books about the topic of migration, and you're launching the most recent work, How Migration Really Works. So that has to be my first question, to try to start breaking down this topic and explaining why it's not that simple. How does migration really work?
Well, perhaps we'll start with stating how migration does not work. When you hear politicians, you often get the impression that migration policy is like opening and closing a tap. And it's typically not how migration works. Migration is part and parcel of who we are as human beings, as societies. So migration is literally of all times. As long as humanity exists, people have been moving around. And what you see in the debate is that you get this framing, and that is really the biggest problem, of pro and anti-migration. And that is a very silly way of talking about a topic like migration. You wouldn't hear a person or a journalist asking a journalist whether she or he is against or in favor of the economy. And that, of course, makes clear how simplistic and how damaging it is to approach a migration topic like that. So in a way, migration is a natural part of who we are. We need to normalize the way we talk about migration, not a priori as a problem to be solved or as a solution to problems, but as it is in the first place. And I think the basic lesson is that migration is something normal that humans have always been trying to do. And what we see that a lot of policy and debate is based on the presumption that we can wish it away or organize it away. And that typically leads to policy approaches that are either ineffective or completely counterproductive. So migration is not like a tap you open and close, because, and that typically leads to the kind of policies that don't seem to be very effective.
I think politicians use that tap at strategic moments when they want to, I think, also tap in to some fears or some emotions that can lead to votes, and can get people on their side or against a particular opponent, and we'll delve into that a little bit later. I think what's curious and what's pertinent as well to be having this conversation, why I was so much looking forward to it, is that I've lived abroad for 20 years. You've lived abroad for several years as well. You lived from the Netherlands, like I mentioned, but you've lived in the UK, you live in Morocco. So we also have different perspectives, right, about what it is to be a migrant, because we went through that process. So I think it's important also to try to define a little bit of the different types of migration that happens, because I think too many times everybody gets kind of painted with the same brush.
We tend to pathologize migration, particularly when it's migration from the so-called global south to the global north. And there is this idea that when we see images of boats across the Mediterranean or so-called caravans through Mexico, and when we talk about illegal migration, we get this impression there is this big difference between us Europeans moving, you know, we are the expats moving to other countries, and then we frame the other coming from non-European countries as the desperate victim fleeing all sorts of misery. And I think that is a misconception, because also when we look at migrations within Africa, for instance, or from Africa, the large majority of them are not the poorest of the poorest. For them, for most migrants, also wherever you go to the world, migration is an investment in a better future. It doesn't mean it always works, but so we have this idea that even in the word term of language, many students, when I ask them, are you a migrant, international students, they would say, no, I'm not a migrant. Or if you ask a professional migrant, no, I'm not a migrant, I'm an expat. And this is how we divided the world up. Because we know very well, if you're higher educated, the higher educated move way more than the lower educated. But it is true for Africa too, or for Latin America, because migration is expensive. Migration requires a particular mindset, and that typically comes with education. So migration is development. One famous migration scholar that inspired me a lot, Ronald Skeldon, wrote this whole book about migration and development, and he said we have to reverse the way we think about it. Migration is part of development. As societies evolve, people have always been moving, and with the whole experience of modernization, people have been on the move. We talk about urbanization, people moving from rural to urban areas. Mm-hmm. That is the biggest form of migration we've witnessed over the last two centuries. For instance, there are more people migrating within China than international migrants in the world.
Wow.
And it is part of the process. So you may not like modernization, you may not like capitalism, you may not like urbanization, but it is part of the process. So we cannot think it away in a way. And the same for rich countries in the West. They have labor shortages that draw in people. So to imagine a wealthy open market economy like we have in Western Europe, and at the same time not wanting to have immigration, that is two things you cannot have at the same time. So you cannot have your cake and eat it too.
No. It's interesting because I remember specific cases of the perception of the immigrant when I was in the United States, and I went there for the first time. I was studying there when it was in the 90s, and then I was there right before September 11th. And after September 11th was a completely different story. I'll just share a couple of them with you, because when my name was Pedro, the first, and I was studying there, everybody assumed I was Mexican, okay?
Right.
And when I said I was from Portugal, first of all, they were confused because they didn't know where Portugal was. Yeah. Second of all, their opinion of me changed instantly, okay? And I always found the Mexican community in the United States to be incredibly hardworking. And then we'll get to the perception and how some politicians have used, obviously, the immigration and the image of Mexicans to their favor. And then after September 11th, I specifically remember being in a shopping center, and my mother was there visiting at the time, and we were speaking Portuguese, and I was in Atlanta, Georgia, and they kind of mistook the language you were speaking for Arabic. And we actually had a security guard following us around because of the tension that was built up in the country. And I was in the southeast, so there it's particularly intense. And again, when I actually had an interaction with him and I said, we're from Portugal, we're from Europe, then it kind of relaxed. I think it's so difficult, isn't it, to educate people on the way we should receive migrants, and it shouldn't be automatically different on where they're coming from and have these prejudices of why they're here and what they're trying to do to us.
Yeah, and that is something you see throughout modern history if you go back a century to the United States, or actually over a century ago. The ultimate scare migrant group in the United States were Germans initially. And there was a big fear in the late 19th century in the United States that German would take over English as the main language of communication. Totally unimaginable right now. The next group that was targeted were Italians.
Yeah.
There were serious discussions in the United States whether Italians, more specifically Sicilians, were actually white. And there were very racist discourses by very established intellectual leaders that said we need to clean the scum of the melting pot, literally. They talked about these populations. Later, Eastern European Jews that came to the United States. So, and Catholics more in general, there's been a very long time until the 1960s that many groups in the United States wanted to define the US as a Protestant nation and saw Catholic immigration as potentially undermining the US society. And Catholics for a very long time have been, the same in England, have Irish migrants to England have been seen as potentially being more loyal to the Pope in Rome than to the nation. The fact that this is completely unimaginable now reminds us of the fact that what is now seen as the enemy, or being constructed by the far right often as the enemy that is more loyal to some other thing, The same with Jewish conspiracy theories, and what we now see with narratives towards Muslim migrants are fairly a modification or a copy almost of those kind of theories. So the, what we now call the replacement conspiracy theory is not so different from these other theories about Catholics or Jews undermining the nation. So it is history repeating itself. Mm. And again, politicians jumping on that bandwagon as one way of winning the next election.
I wanted to get into the myths that you kind of break down in your book, because I always like to say numbers don't lie. Sometimes they're a tool that's used selectively to benefit one side or another, but I think what's particularly interesting in your book is you look at the facts. These are the facts. This is what they tell us about immigration. And so let's get into that. What are the biggest myths that you think need to be debunked and need to be broken down, and how does your book aim to do that?
I think the most important, apart from the one we already discussed about migration, it's not being a tap you open and close, is this idea that we live in times of unprecedented mass migration,
yeah.
That we have more and more refugees, more and more illegal migration. It's a sort of global crisis. This is actually shared across the ideological spectrum. Although it's represented differently, but the idea that because of a combination of factors like poverty, inequality, oppression, conflict, climate change, and in combination with a greater ease of transport and moving around, that we see this global surge of migration and this idea that the West is potentially going to be overwhelmed with waves of migrants coming across the border, whether from Africa to Europe or from Latin America to the United States. And it is actually shared across the board. The interesting thing is that if you look at the left and the right wing sort of sides of the political spectrum, the kind of solutions, which are also problematic, are different. On the right, you'll hear more often more borders, more control. On the left, you may hear stories about we need to prevent conflict, we need to prevent poverty to decrease migration. But the underlying assumption, and that is one of the discoveries I made doing the background research for my book, that some of those myths are actually shared, although the kind of responses in terms of policy may be quite different, but the idea that there's this growing mass of people moving around. Now, when we look at the data, we get a little bit more calmer. If we look, for instance, at the numbers of migrants in the world, yeah, there has been an increase. So the number of people living not in their country of birth, but the world population has increased as well. So if we would express levels of migration in relative terms, nowadays 3-3.5% of the world population is an international migrant. That percentage was roughly similar 50 years ago, and almost certainly was actually higher a century ago, because that was a time of transatlantic movements of Europeans to the Americas. What has changed is the direction of migration, particularly from a Eurocentric perspective. Because it were, of course, Europeans who for centuries were the ultimate emigrants, who colonized other nations, who settled in other nations, who moved people around the earth. Think about the slave trade, but also about the coolie movement. So the indentured workers from Asia who were brought by the British and the Dutch and the French to work in the Caribbean. So it was European colonialism that drove migration. But it was not a migration that was directed to Europe. That pattern has completely changed over the last 50 years because of decolonization, because of the fact that Europe has become so wealthy, our populations have been aging, increasing levels of education, and all these factors combined meant that there was a growing demand for labor in industries and services. And that has been the single biggest cause for this reversal. I call it the global migration reversal, which for Europe has been a complete game changer. Because Europe has transformed from the ultimate continent of out-migration to a very important destination of world migrants. So it is not about world migration getting out of hand, it is Europe's place, geopolitical place, but with that also its place on the global migration map has completely changed around. And that is a real change. So more and more European countries are receiving more and more migrants from non-European countries. That is, of course, a real change. That, of course, triggers reactions and anxiety and excitement and political debate. So that is completely understandable. But that is a Eurocentric perspective on the world. But from a world perspective, you cannot really maintain that migration is running out of hand or this is big acceleration.
It'd be fair to say that over the last 15 years, the Francisco and Mulder Centers Foundation has tried to bring facts, bring figures, bring data to Portuguese people. And obviously your book is based on a lot of facts across the landscape in this topic. Nowadays, it seems that, at least in my lifetime, I find people are more resistant to facts than they ever have been. Do you agree with that? And what are some of the facts that you find people don't want to hear or they don't want to see from the messages in your book?
I'm not sure whether people are not open to facts. I think the quality of the public debate is very poor.
Okay.
We see a growing disconnect between the knowledge we have in the academia and the public debate. I think it is too simplistic to only put the blame on politicians and media. I think it is also up to academics to, in a way, get out of the ivory tower and communicate those insights, because we've become so specialized. And also, if you look at the way how academic careers are being made, it's very much l'art pour l'art, the idea of, you know, talking to your own constituencies in terms of other researchers. But I think it is really important to create that connection between the public debate and what we know in terms of knowledge. But the problem is primarily not one of facts, I believe. The problem is one of discourse and narratives. Facts don't speak for themselves. Mm. Because if I say only 3% of the world population is a migrant, if you live in a neighborhood where 40% of the people are an immigrant, it's not relevant to you. So if you are not able to connect with how people experience these things in very different ways, in concrete ways, then of course you get a more mixed picture. And if you look at opinion polls about migration, most people have quite ambivalent views on migration. The number of people who are really against any form of migration is very small. The number of people who are totally in favor of open borders is also quite small. Most people understand that to a large degree, if you just look at who is working in restaurants, hotels, who's cleaning houses, who's taking care of people, who's delivering food, who's driving taxis, in most Western countries, you know that migrants do all sorts of useful jobs, or indeed high-skilled migrants working in high-skilled jobs. At the same, people may be worried about things they see on television. If people drown in the Mediterranean, that's a real cause for concern, obviously. Mm-hmm. If there is segregation happening and real problems happening, these problems are real too. So we need to get rid of that pro, anti, good, bad framing of migration. We need to tell real stories, but just facts, that doesn't work. Because then it becomes very generic. If I would say to a person concerned about changing environment in their neighborhood, lots of migrants coming, people not being able to speak their own language, and there may be tensions around it, then of course it's up to governments to do something about that, to address those problems. And then just put a figure like, oh, only 3% of the world population is a migrant and it was the same a century ago. That is not the way to communicate knowledge. You need to relate in a way. So I think we need better stories. And what I really hope is that politicians, but also journalists and writers and any other leading figures in the public debate will gather the courage to tell a different story about migration. But you need to ground that story in knowledge. And I think that was the problem with migration, that the debate has so spun out of control that it has no relation to facts anymore. And I think that's the problem.
It's so difficult nowadays as well when we consume information. A lot of us do it on social media or certainly digitally. And it becomes increasingly difficult to tell the difference between an opinion and a fact because you're constantly bombarded with so many things. And I think it's so important what you said about whether it's scientists, whether it's researchers, whether it's specialists, being able to get those facts and turn it into a story so people can also consume it like they're consuming a lot of the other narratives that are being pushed in our face, sometimes through propaganda and through paid ventures as well. We were both in the UK when the kind of Brexit wave started. We saw migration be a crucial topic in the elections in the United States that eventually led to Donald Trump's victory two mandates back. How much are politicians making this an issue? And you mentioned right and left are kind of using this topic in different ways, but that it is there, it's present there. How much are they using it nowadays from your experience in Europe? And do you continue to predict that this will be a very emotional issue that will be used for votes? And does it worry you?
It definitely worries me. What worries me in particular is that the more centrist parties in many countries start to take over the far-right narratives. And the far-right narratives that obviously represent migration as an invasion and that scapegoat migrants for all sorts of real problems that exist. Growing inequality, declining job security, declining purchasing power of the poorest, problem with access to healthcare and affordable housing, no longer being sure whether you get a job, whether you have a university education. These are real problems and things people are worried about. And it's very attractive for the same generation of politicians that have pursued all those reforms, those economic reforms that have led to growing inequality, that have led to growing economic insecurity of lower income earners or even the middle classes, to put the blame on migrants. It's very attractive because it diverts the attention away from the fact that those socioeconomic insecurities that people feel, that they're in a way not as good off as their parents were, or if that their kids may be worse off than them, those anxieties are real in a sense. But it is very attractive for politicians who don't want to change those policies after 30 to 40 years of what is often dubbed as neoliberal economic policies. There's big interest not to reverse those policies. So in that setting, it becomes very attractive to suggest that migration has caused all of these problems, to divert the attention away. And the second political mechanism is fear-mongering, because we know that the best vehicle to come to power and rally support is to create fear, because it creates for politicians an opportunity to portray themselves as saviors, who's going to win the war against the external enemy. Now, if you don't have a real external enemy, I mean, waging war is the best way to win an election in many cases, then you invent an external enemy, and this is where the invasion rhetorics come from. But those same politicians that tell those stories don't provide any solutions to the issue. And a good example is Meloni in Italy, who rose to power on an anti-immigration platform, but she's allowing more migrants in than any former prime minister in Italy,
okay,
and has proposed to legalize 500,000 undocumented migrants, because she is also under pressure of business, and she also understands that there are real economic interests and labor shortages that are very real. So what we see right now, that in the political scene, and I recently wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal talking about the American border crisis, I say it's a real crisis, but it's a political crisis that's been going on for the last 30 to 35 years, as in Europe. We haven't been able to fix it, because the more money we've pumped into border controls, the problem hasn't been solved. And a good definition of insanity, often ascribed to Einstein, is trying to do the same over and over and over again and expect different results. Fortress Europe has been a massive failure, that whole idea. Why? Because we don't address the elephant in the room. Because if you look at the political narrative in the United States or in Europe, on the left you'll hear things like, these are all victims and economic refugees, we need to provide protection, and this sort of victim narrative. On the right, it's more this invasion narrative. You know, they come to take our jobs, or worse, they're like Donald Trump kind of narratives about they are rapists and criminals, or they are indeed into a conspiracy to take over our societies. Nobody talks about the real issue, which is that both in Europe, Western Europe, and in the United States, we have higher labor shortages than ever, particularly for lower-skilled migrants. We don't have legal channels to accommodate that demand. And the result is people keep on crossing borders illegally because they know there's going to be a job for them. When I was in El Paso at the U.S.-American border last year, and we interviewed migrants who were waiting in Ciudad Juarez on the other side, everybody was talking about work. And a very illuminating statistic is the following. In the United States, the number of employers that get prosecuted on a yearly basis for employing undocumented migrants is somewhere between 10 and 15 a year without any zeros added. That is about a chance to be hit by lightning. And
I thought you were going to say percent after the 10 or 15.
In absolute numbers. And in Europe, it's not much. In Europe, it's not much better. In Britain, where there was this whole narrative created by both Labour and Conservatives about a hostile environment towards illegal migration, similar numbers. And it shows the huge hypocrisy politically that, of course, if you would really be serious as a politician, like they always say, I want to combat smuggling, I want to combat illegal migration. If you really want to do that, you better punish employers. Because you can punish migrants, that makes migrants worse off. If migrants are afraid to get deported, it makes it easier to exploit them for employers. Mm-hmm. If employers don't face any consequences, they will keep on doing that. But the employers is not just big capitalists, it's also families that hire a domestic worker, or families that hire somebody to take care of their elderly parents, to clean their house. So it's not just a matter of capital versus labor, the middle classes are involved in that. So there's a huge political hypocrisy around this issue that the very migrants who are so important, we saw this in the COVID crisis, who was delivering the food? Who was the whole food chain in a way? Who's picking the vegetables? Who is slaughtering the animals? Who's processing the food? Who's cooking the food? And who was delivering the food to the houses of the middle class? Almost in all cases, migrants, often without papers. So when we talk about essential work, it's exactly the migrants that are often portrayed as unnecessary migrants, unwanted migrants, are the ones doing actually very essential work. There is no political recognition of that fact. So there is a total lack of credibility if politicians say, I want to have less immigration or I want to combat illegal migration, because people will find a way to cross borders if they know there's going to be jobs. And even a perfect fence is not going to prevent that, because we also know from research that most undocumented migrants came legally. For instance, took a plane from Brazil to Portugal on a passport and just stayed longer than you're allowed to stay. So even the perfect fence will not be able to prevent it.
I'm glad you brought up Portugal, because I actually wanted to address our small country and the way that it has received migrants historically. And even though I lived abroad for many years, I've obviously been coming back all the time. The attitude towards migration has changed somewhat, and I notice it in my community. Portugal has been traditionally a very friendly country to expats. The type of immigration has changed somewhat over the last decade. First of all, as far as numbers, it's increased drastically. And the kind of immigration has also been focused on labor and a lot of service jobs. In your opinion, and taking into account your expertise and your experience, maybe this is a naive question, but I want to get into it, is what's the perfect immigration policy, or what's the advised immigration policy for a country like Portugal? We've expanded a lot from a tourism perspective. Obviously, we have a lot more hotels, a lot more restaurants popping up everywhere, so there is a need for labor. There is an increase in migration. What's the policy that a country like ours should have when it comes to accepting people, legalizing people, and making sure that there is a smooth transition and that these people are integrated as well?
Just to acknowledge, I mean, there's a very long and complicated answer. There is a simple answer in the sense of a sort of principle. Where it often goes wrong is when we don't acknowledge that migrants are people. Migrants too often are treated like production factors, works that come in handily. We don't realize that the social dynamics of migration. These are people with needs. When workers in the beginning come, they're often welcome because everybody understands to do useful work, but they also have families. And if we don't acknowledge that migration also comes with a degree of settlement, because we often like to not even think about it really. We think, okay, it's useful, but perhaps one day they will go back or something like that. There's this famous quote of the Swiss writer Max Frisch, who wrote in the context of the 1960s in Switzerland about Italian guest workers in Switzerland. It is very difficult to imagine right now, but at the time, the influx of Italian guest workers was seen as a threat in Switzerland. There was a specific German term called Überfremdung. They were afraid to be overwhelmed by foreigners. And he said, he already described what often goes wrong with lower skilled workers, the kind of guest worker conundrum. And here's this famous quote where he said, "We wanted workers, we got people instead." And it really summarizes the whole conundrum. And what often has gone wrong as well, I think we should draw lessons from the so-called guest worker experience of the 1960s and 1970s in countries like Germany, France, or the Netherlands. Because the idea was, we'll get workers to work in industries, mines, services, and once their job is done, they're going to go back.
Yeah.
Then the crisis hits. There's always going to be a crisis. And what happens in the next recession, the first who will be expelled from those jobs will be migrants. Last in, first out. Discrimination plays a role. And then the problems arise. If you haven't really thought through that these are indeed people that often have come with families, that have been around for 4, 5, 6 years, very unlikely to going to go back. And then look the other way, not to take responsibility for that, and then you may create your problems. So overall, the integration experience has been very successful, but there have been groups, for instance in French banlieues, who've suffered from year-long exclusion and mass unemployment. And that, of course, creates social problems down the line. If the second generation doesn't get access to good education and career opportunities, that, of course, can create social problems. But it is rooted in the fact that governments didn't embrace or acknowledge that these people were there to stay. So I think in the case of Portugal, indeed, it's a new phenomenon, particularly to have migrants from non-Portuguese-speaking countries and settling here. What we know from migration research, that's another sort of what a lot of migration researchers quip, there's nothing more permanent than a temporary migrant. Don't create any illusions that a fair share of migrants is not going to stay. So if you now have your share of Bangladeshi, Pakistani, Nepalese migrants, if this will continue for another 4 or 5 years, the probability of having permanent settlement is very high. And then you can resist that fact, and this is what went wrong often. If governments resist it and don't put in place policies to prevent marginalization, segregation, then you set yourself up for trouble.
What are some of those policies that seem to work? From your experience across the world, because you're right, I think for many years as well, there were the expats and international workers who were here with international companies. We've seen a big influx of a Brazilian population, but that makes it easier for their integration, obviously, not only language, but culturally. But with these other countries that you mentioned, whether that's Bangladesh, Pakistan, Nepal, etc., there is a barrier. There's a cultural barrier and there's a language barrier. So what could we learn?
Make sure that the second generation gets access to education, prevent segregation for the second generation, because kids are integrating naturally if they get in touch with mainstream society. I mean, kids learn language flawlessly, right? If they just in the street, at least if they have the opportunity to play with kids from that grew up already in Portugal or any country. I think it's the prevention of segregation that's the most important thing. But if governments turn a blind eye for too long, for instance, I know that in agriculture as well, in the south of Portugal, there are a lot of migrants working, living completely segregated. And if governments don't take responsibility for those populations, you set yourself up for trouble. Because if kids grow up in impoverished migrant communities where there is no opportunities for social mobility, if they go to schools where they don't get incentivized to learn the language or to go further in life, then you set yourself up for trouble. It's the looking away of governments, and that I think is a lack of responsibility taking for politicians, who frame migrants as the enemy, the same migrants who do all these essential jobs. Because they frame them as the enemy, they don't take responsibility for the populations they have allowed in or tolerate, basically. And toleration sounds nice, but toleration has a shadow side. It's like, we tolerate you being around, but you can never be really part of society. So you create a segregation problem for the future. I just want to emphasize that for the vast majority of immigrant groups all around the world, if you look at the second generation, immense successes, amazing successes. But the dangers exist there where you have the combination of crisis, residential segregation, and then these areas can develop into poverty traps. And then the second generation, of course, will get frustrated in many ways. And then you can get social reactions that you could see in some of the banlieues and other neighborhoods across northwestern Europe where the impoverished migrant population is being concentrated. So to put it differently, I think that the American sociologist Alejandro Portes is one of the most famous researchers in migration studies. He has said the question is not whether migrants integrate. He says all migrants integrate because the second generation will learn Portuguese, no doubt about it. The question is in what segment of the society they integrate. Yeah. And he used this concept of downward assimilation. If migrants assimilate into a sort of underclass, a sort of permanent underclass, which is a result of failure of governments to make sure that segregation doesn't happen, and you could do that as a government. I can give an example. You could say to employers who allow migrants in that they have to provide decent housing, or you can, you know, force them to set a particular, to invest resources into the correct reception of migrant communities, to make sure that schools don't get segregated, to make sure that neighborhoods are reasonably mixed. And this has to do with housing policy. And it often went wrong when governments have built those huge estates where only migrants live, basically, and haven't provided enough mixed housing. And in most countries where there is a sort of ripe mix of housing in terms of lower and higher income groups, you also see much more mingling of migrants and non-migrants, and that generally works much better than basically isolating people. So I think segregation is the main problem, and it's a government responsibility.
We're wrapping up our conversation, and we always finish with a series of quick-fire questions. But before we get to that, last question for you. From a European standpoint, from an EU standpoint, what do you expect to be the main shift in immigration policy over the next decade, so to speak?
Depends on whether you would ask what I hope and what the worst outcome could be. I mean, the worst outcome is a race to the bottom in terms of taking rights away from migrants and trying to further fortify border controls, because it's going to lead to more misery in many ways. It's going to not solve the issue. But I'm also hopeful, because many people think that the victories that quite some far-right parties have made across Europe means that people increasingly become racist and anti-immigrant. That is actually not supported by public opinion research. Mm. Public opinion research shows that most people are very ambivalent, have mixed feelings about immigration, they have certain worries, indeed, about segregation or isolation of particular migrant groups. They may be worried if they see things on television about boats and caravans, for good reasons. At the same time, most people do realize that migrants do good jobs. It's essential jobs. People have migrants as neighbors. A typical thing you hear, well, I don't like immigrants, but my Turkish neighbor, he's fine, you know? It is a typical reaction people have. So I think most people are aware of that. And there is no clear right-left-wing divide as much as you would think. For instance, many religiously conservative people also know, as a religious duty, you have to welcome the stranger. So there is this mixed feelings often about migration. We also see it politically. So right-wing parties, let's say conservative parties, often see migration on the one hand as this potential threat for cultural identity and things like that. At the same time, those parties have a very strong business orientation that wants to keep borders open. On the left-wing side, we have this cultural progressive voice about open borders, but also trade unions who've been quite hostile towards the unlimited influx of migrant workers. So, but opinion polls actually show a very mixed picture, and I think the biggest sign of hope in a way is that there is no shift against immigration. The long-term trends are rather into more positive views towards immigration. You wouldn't think that. What the far right has successfully done is draw in that vote, that anti-immigrant vote that has always existed, but the mainstream parties never made political capital out because their own constituencies are divided on the issue. So the far right has successfully drawn that vote in. But the share of the population, particularly if you look at younger people in Europe, mm-hmm. that thinks moderately about migration actually has increased, not decreased.
Okay.
So I do think, but perhaps it's wishful thinking, that the current political narratives we've been discussing and the hypocrisy is getting almost unbearable right now. It's like this big smokescreen politicians are putting, many politicians, not all of them, but many politicians put those smokescreens about framing migrant workers who do all these jobs as the enemy or refugees. At the same time, I think the hypocrisy is becoming so big that I think there is more and more space for a more moderate narrative about migration. And my hope is that there will be a new generation of politicians that dares to tell the real story about migration. Not about migration being a good or a bad thing, but something that is inevitable,
yeah.
that we have to learn to deal with, that can have negative sides as well as positive sides, and that we need to think much more critically about what kind of policies can make sure that all members of society benefit from migration, and not just employers and a few other people who benefit from it, but that spread the benefits more evenly and make sure that people who, let's say the lowest income earners who don't see many economic benefits from immigration can also benefit from it. And this is ultimately a question about labor, because the way we treat migrant workers reflects on the way we treat workers more in generally. And I think that comes back to the initial issue we discussed about the growing inequality mm-hmm. in Western societies, and particularly the lowest income earners that have lost out on globalization, that have lost out on liberalization. That is a much broader issue. Of course, immigration hasn't caused those problems, but it's very effective and attractive for politicians who don't want to pursue those reforms, let's say more social reforms, to improve the position of workers more in general, to basically use a divide and rule ideology yeah. by portraying the migrant as an issue, as the ultimate cause of growing inequality, growing job insecurity. It's a very effective divide and rule strategy, and I think that needs to be broken because the hypocrisy is simply getting too big. So I'm a born optimist, but I think we cannot afford to be pessimistic in a way, because I do think the scare is real. I think we live in an important junction of time, that the biggest danger I see is that centrist parties, whether they are slightly to the right or slightly to the left, are increasingly taking over those far-right narratives, and I think that is really dangerous. That is why I'm really hoping that centrist politicians take the responsibility, also because of the fact that copying the narrative of the far right is not going to bring them electoral victory in the first place, because we know from political science that people will vote for the original, not for the copy. But secondly, I think it is very dangerous because you start to normalize these ideas that are plainly racist, that only create more division. And I find the irony that the same far-right politicians that say immigration is a scare for social cohesion, is gonna, you know, create more and more insecurity, actually their narratives create division. And politicians should take responsibility to try to keep society together. And the issue is that migrants will be part of our future society. If you don't embrace that fact, you set yourself up for failure. So there's a lot of wishful thinking going on, but I do think there is real reason for hope.
Okay, so quick fire, three questions for you in one sentence or in one word. What is the personality trait that a good leader could really benefit from having?
Responsibility taking.
If you could change anything in the world by magic right now, today, in 10 minutes, what would it be?
Wow. Teach that people would see that what they project on a migrant is ultimately about ourselves. We project a lot of our fears on migrants.
Very true. And finally, I also want to get your take on what is the most important learning of your life and career that you'd like to share with us.
Most important learning of my career.
I like that you're really thinking about this. Oh, I like it. Makes it more meaningful than...
Well, I think it reflects back on what we've discussed before, is that I think it would be very useful for all people in the world. We used to have military service in our societies. I think it would really be useful if people, all young people, would spend at least 3 or 6 months in a totally different country. And then you start to realize how privileged we are in the Western society. What I really, my biggest learning moment was when I lived in Morocco and I was still really young and had friends at my age having the same dreams. That's one thing you discover, that you're not that different. So the outside looks very different. The first lesson is that you, by staying in another country and interacting with people there and really living with them, you learn that we are not that different in the first place. But second, you also start to realize that what is so normal for people moving around is not normal anymore for many other people in the world. If you take away that right from people, the right to go where you want, people are getting angry. It is like living in a dictatorship. People go in the street, they're willing to die, right, for democracy. Right now we're depriving a big chunk of the world population to try out life. That's what people used to do. And being somewhere in a totally different society, not as a tourist, but really participating, I think it would be such a healing experience to, first of all, not be too dramatic about the problems in Western societies, and also to understand what we are doing, in a way, by creating all these barriers.
That was the longest sentence I've ever heard in my life, but I let you finish it because it was good.
Thank you.
Eindehas, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us on It's Not That Simple. Fantastic to get your insight and expertise on such an important topic. Good luck with your most recent work, How Migration Really Works, and continued success in your career. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's Not That Simple is a podcast from Francisco Manuel dos Santos Foundation. Tune in every month at ffms.pt or subscribe on the usual platforms.